I wonder how often we've had a conversation with someone where they described a friend or someone they met at a party, and it's so vivid, they make the description so vivid that you feel you know that person talked about, that you could almost visualize them and treat them as a friend. Well, that's how I feel about John's gospel. John is a very special gospel, a very intimate gospel, quite different from the other three. And it has a quality about it of such depth and such intimacy that you get to know Jesus in a very special way, a way that really is typical of John. He was, after all, the disciple that Jesus loved. He was very close to the Lord, and he knew things about Jesus and experienced things that the others didn't. And so the remarkable thing is that, in fact, he not only tells us what Jesus did, but very often he gives us the reason, the underlying spiritual reason behind what Jesus did. So, for instance, in a chapter just ahead, chapter 6, we read about Jesus healing the blind man, a man blind from birth, chapter 9. And that follows Jesus saying that he's the light of the world. Chapter 6, he feeds the 5,000. And that's followed by the discourse about Jesus being the bread of life. When he raises Lazarus from the dead, Jesus talks about how he is the resurrection and the life. Great depth. And he includes stories that aren't found anywhere else. For instance, the story today, the wedding at Cana and the miraculous change of water into wine, is not found in the other Gospels. Nor, by the way, is the raising of Lazarus, nor Nicodemus coming to Jesus in the night. But then on the other side, he also omits some of the things that the other evangelists put into their Gospels. For instance, there are no parables in John. And there are also, you don't get any of the birth narratives or the genealogies. Now, there are very good reasons for that, because John was writing around the year AD 100, so a long time after the other evangelists. We don't know exactly when Matthew, Mark, and Luke wrote their Gospels, but usually most commentators think it's around the middle of the first century, so between AD 40 and AD 60. John, writing much later, around the year 100, was writing to a new generation of Christians. And these Christians and these people on the fringes of the church were no longer just Jews. They included Jews, but the second generation included a lot of Greeks, Greek Gentiles. And these people had a different set of priorities. For instance, a Greek wouldn't be interested in the genealogies because they were very Jewish things. Jews liked the genealogies. The Greeks wouldn't be particularly interested in Jesus being the son of David, because that was not a king that they particularly knew about and were interested in. But they were interested in the Word of God. They had this concept of logos, the Word of God. So when Jesus says he is the Word and he's described as the Word of God, that was something a Greek could understand. They could also understand that he was the true vine, because they lived in a world where a lot of them believed that there was a sort of reality on earth which was imperfect. And somewhere, up there somewhere, there was a perfect reality, that everything here was modeled on the imperfect. So when Jesus says he is the true vine, he's the real bread, he's, you know, those things meant something to those believers. So we are full of meaning, full of depths of meaning. And basically, I'd like to devote the next few minutes to talking about three audiences that John has with the story. The first is the people that actually experienced it. So what actually happened, and why did it happen? When did it happen? So what happened in Cana? Second thing is, what was the experience of people reading that story later on, the Jews and the Greeks of AD 100 and later? And finally, what can we draw out of it for ourselves? What is there in that story for us? Well, first of all, we have the event itself. Mary is already at the wedding. This is interesting. It says Mary was there already, if you see that. And then Jesus and his disciples arrived. Now, the way that Mary is already there, and the way that she then talks to the servants indicates that she had some function or role at that wedding. She had, so a lot of people say that perhaps she was even the sister of the bridegroom's mother. And some people have even ventured to say that John knows the story so intimately that maybe John himself was the bridegroom. Maybe we're hearing about John's own wedding, but that may be a bit too far-fetched. But anyhow, I like the thought of it. Anyhow, Mary is there. The disciples arrive. Some people say they ran out of wine because they started all these extra guys turned up. But whatever the reason, Mary says to her son, the wine's run out, and he responds. Now, it's interesting that he performs his first public ministry, his first miracle, first thing he does at a wedding, a time of joy, but not only a wedding, but an ordinary wedding, just ordinary people in a small, tiny village. And that says a lot about the type of ministry that Jesus has. I'll come back to that in a minute. So he does it for these ordinary people, ordinary villagers, bringing happiness and joy to them and saving them from embarrassment, because obviously to run out of wine would have been a terrible thing. The Jews used to say, the rabbis used to say, you can't have a feast without wine. No wine, no joy. In fact, it reminds me of these signs you see in France in vineries, if you've traveled around France, they say, un repas sans vin, c'est un jour sans soleil. You know, a meal without wine is a day without sunshine. So for some people, wine is jolly important. It's the essence of a good time. And this is what we're talking about here. Jesus saved the day and was interested in them having a good time, not being embarrassed, not being in a bad place. But what did the Greeks make of it? Well, for the Greeks, of course, first of all, maybe we should talk about the Jewish symbolism. There's a lot of symbolism. There were six large jars. Now, six is an imperfect number for the Jews. Seven is the perfect number. And Jesus is saying to the Jewish readers of the first century, look, something imperfect, and I have brought perfection. I have made something beautiful. My grace has been poured out over this imperfect number of jars, if you like. Also, the Greeks, of course, would have seen something else there. The Greeks were very invested in a god called Dionysus, god of wine. He was called Bacchus among the Romans, and he was the god of happiness and joy and celebration. They believed that Dionysus could kind of fix things when people got unhappy, and he would come to him to bring joy. But they also had a funny wine conversion story. There was a tradition or a myth among the Greeks that once a year in a particular town called Phias, there was a temple into which people brought two cups of empty cups and put them in a sealed room. So they would seal in the presence of all the people, the room would be sealed. And when they broke the seals in the morning and went in, there were two full cups of wine from Dionysus. And Jesus was saying to the Greeks through this miracle, look, you have your gods and you think, you know, and you sort of have these myths about wine appearing from nowhere, but I'm the true vine. I'm the one who can do all those things that your gods could never do. I go beyond the wildest ability of your imperfect mythological gods. So that would have been a very clear message. Another thing he said, actually, he said, my hour has not yet come. This would be very significant because the hour of Jesus coming is a theme that comes up again. He speaks of the hour again and again in the Gospels. For John, it's the hour of his manifestation, coming into the world and showing himself to be both God and man. For the other apostles, for the other evangelists, it's the hour of his crucifixion, the hour when he would die. And of course, as Elizabeth has already said, the whole thing forecasts would be seen. I don't know if you noticed, it starts on the third day. Now imagine what that would mean. The third day has a very special significance for Christians, hasn't it? Because the third day is the day that Jesus rose from the dead. And so by coming to this banquet, he comes and it's a symbol of joy. It's a symbol of, as Elizabeth has said in her introduction, of the heavenly banquet. It's a time, it forecasts, it all leads up to the time when Jesus would be crucified, he would die, he would rise from the grave, and he would return to establish his kingdom. And that's all very, very rich. So there we are. So the gospel was written full of meaning for the Greeks, full of meaning for us too. Let's look at what does the wedding in Cana have to say to us? Well, first of all, the first thing we need to realize that the stories of Jesus, the narrative of Jesus, is not about things that he did 2,000 years ago, and we just say, oh, wonderful. But everything is a continuation. The things he did then, he continues to do throughout history. He's doing them now. Every story that John tells is not about something that happened a long time ago. It's about something that he is still doing today. And as we see, the first thing he did, as I've already said, is to bring joy. And he continues to bring joy to his followers today. Joy is not always the same as happiness, as we all know. Joy is really that feeling of being in the right place, doing the things that he intended us to do, being the people that he wants us to be. And the gospel is not about looking like Jesus. The wine didn't look like wine. It didn't appear like, it wasn't colored water. It was real wine. It was tasted. And they said, wow, wonderful wine. And Jesus is in the business of transforming us, of changing the ordinary into the extraordinary. It's not about information, the gospel. It's about transformation. It's transforming lives. Jesus doesn't want you to have a new look on the outside. He wants us, you and me, to be different on the inside. He wants us to be less concerned about what we look like than what we are like. Being Christians is not looking like a Christian, talking like a Christian. It is really undergoing a transformation of heart and mind, turning away from sin and giving our lives to him and living in a different way. Those 180 gallons of water were used to clean people's feet. You know, in Palestine, people didn't wear shoes and they didn't have paved roads. Footwear consisted of a piece of leather that was strapped on to your ankles and you walked with that to your feet. And of course, if it was wet, your feet would be nasty and muddy and mucky. And if it was dry, they'd be full of dust. So people had to have their feet washed, and they had the ritual washing of their hands. So they needed a lot of water at parties. There were no running water taps there. So they used those jugs. And as I was thinking about that, all the water in the world couldn't really clean us. Those 180 gallons could give us a few baths, but they can't clean us on the inside. That's something that Jesus can do. Similarly, those 180 gallons of wine speak of the superabundance. When we think of what Christ does, it's superabundant. He didn't just give them enough wine for the party. There's no way, if you think about it, that those people could drink 180 gallons of wonderful wine. Too much. But even that would eventually run out. And Jesus again and again says, I give you wine that will never run out. And so as I close this little sharing with you, I'd like to just say a final word about our wine, your wine and my wine, just running out. You know, we look around at the news and you can't help feeling that for a lot of people, the wine is running out, and for some of us, it's run out already. We wonder where the jobs are going to come from, where the mortgage payments are going to come from. A lot of worry. And as I was thinking about these things, I remembered that Jesus performed his first miracle only after the wine had run out. It had gone. And very often in our lives, we find it's only when the wine has run out, when luck has run out, when resources have run out, that Christ steps into our lives. I've experienced it personally. I know one or two of you have gone through the same experience. And sometimes we have to be in a very hard place for God to act. And that is really, God's grace really begins sometimes, is poured out on us when the wine has run out. And what shall we take away with us? Well, same message we take away every week. There is no time like the present to commit to Christ. If you are committed to him, then for goodness sake, recommit. I often reflect on that window. In the summer, by the way, in the summer when you come to, or late summer, when you come to evening services, there's a light behind that window, and you see Jesus. You actually see him very clearly. By the end of the service, it's dark, and he's gone. You can't see him anymore. And it's like that in our lives. We are, all of us, have a season when we see Christ, we have a chance to be with him, relate to him, get intimate with him. But that's a season. It'll pass. And there comes a time in each of our lives when our hearts become hardened, when we are suddenly no longer to see him. It's like that. He's still there, but we can't see him anymore. So this is the time to commit or recommit ourselves to him. Before you go to bed tonight, perhaps just tell him you love him, that you want to be his man or woman, that you want to live like him, be more like him, and that you want to be a transmitter of his grace and his peace and his joy and his comfort in the world. And when you give your life to him, just remember what you can do next. Mary had the words in this reading. She said, "Do whatever he tells you."